right, so today is Monday, October 18. We're in chapter 11. This is slide number 10. And we're going to go on again. Slide chapter 12 is online. So is the chapter 26 reading guide, although it's not due. I have one more, and then we are all done. Hallelujah. Then next year I will get to update it, make it more effective. At any rate, first iteration is what it is. Proximity orientation effects, ladies and gentlemen. These are applicable to what enzymes? All enzymes are boosted by this idea of where the enzyme helps bring the substrates closer together and eliminate the constant rotation and translational movement that prevents an effective collision. All right. So, again, another idea is that the catalysis is helped significantly by this preferential binding of the TS. In this case, of course, the TS stands for what? Transition state. As the substrate binds the active site of the enzyme, active site conformation changes to fit the substrate better. Active site. Now, let's parse the word active site. The active site is actually composed of two components. One is the binding site, which is the site that enhances selectivity, or is an important part of selecting what part of the molecule they're going to attack, or substrate. And there's also the catalytic site. So the active site is composed of two things, the binding site and the catalytic site. The catalytic site is actually where the chemical reaction occurs. All right, so substrate conformation changes to mimic the transition state shape. For an instant, the active site binds the ideal transition state shape very strongly. Catalysis increases sharply because the concentration of TS species is now relatively high. Non-reactive TS analogs are potent enzyme inhibitors. All right, so here you have catalyzed. This is uncatalyzed. And just allow me just to write it here. This is delta G that, and this is delta G this. Catalyzed, uncatalyzed. The crucial idea here is you can say much higher population. So when it's catalyzed, even though this transition state aspect of it is exactly that, transitional or transitory, it at any given instant, whenever with the low, relatively low transition state energy or activation energy due to catalysis, the population at that peak has a much higher population than does the uncatalyzed form. If you can increase the population at the transition state, you immediately provide a mechanism to increase the product formation. And so that's what, in fact, enzymes do in part, is help create an increased population in the transition state. They do this, of course, by both changing their shape as the substrate binds into the ideal form or ideal shape, and then stretching and bending the substrate as it binds so it can form the ideal transition state. So you can see here, in this line, of course, you've got that uncatalyzed state, and then you've got a wobbly line that indicates that there is some sort of new pathway. I want you to note, of course, that the binding of that transition state, the binding of the enzyme with the transition state,
has an energy cost. You know, you're going, well, Dr. Novak, you're saying as the substrate and as the enzyme begin to interact, you know, there's some bending and conformational changes in the enzyme, and there's also some stretching and forming in the substrate. Doesn't that cost energy? And the answer is absolutely yes, it does cost energy. And you can see that in this little hillock right here. You've got an energy barrier that occurs as the enzyme and substrate interact. And that's where the stretching and bending occurs. Where the mutual stretching, conformational change of the enzyme, and the stretching and bending of the substrate occur. But you can tell that energy cost, that energy barrier is relatively low. And for reactions that are occurring at 37 degrees, there's plenty of thermal energy in the environment to allow for that bending and stretching to occur between the two between the substrate and the enzyme. And so, but there, notice that enzyme substrate, just the binding of it is favorable. But as it begins to bind, it forms, and there is a thermodynamic tendency to move forward because, of course, this particular reaction is favorable. Then you form that as temporary enzyme substrate transition state. You then make the products right here that are bound to the enzyme temporarily, assuming that you make, you know, two products, or you make a product, in which you normally do. But there is a minimum energy state there, and then you've got to overcome the release energy to finally get the free enzyme and the final product loose from it. So there's an energy barrier to creating the enzyme substrate complex. There's an energy barrier that has to be overcome to release the product from the enzyme. But whatever it is, these barriers are relatively low, and the transition state complex is much lower in energy, in free energy requirement, than is the uncatalyzed form. And the overall net effect is to rapidly increase the rate of the reaction, again, by increasing the population, the transition state. That's one model for that. The other idea here is number four. Non-reactive TS analogs are potent enzyme inhibitors. So this binding state and this enzyme transition state, of course, since the substrate in its idealized transition state matches the conformation of the enzyme so well, there's a nice tight binding. If you wouldn't mind holding my hand, thank you very much. Now, if I was the evil, if I was Sauron, for example, and I wanted to, he was an enzyme that was causing a disease state, if I would shake his hand but not let go, because I bind so tightly, in other words, I never make a product, I'm stuck here and here, right in that region, okay, if his activity was too much, it was causing a disease state, by binding so tightly I never let go, his activity, of course, would immediately drop, and thus ameliorating some level of that disease state. That's what drugs do. It's kind of like an intelligent design for drugs. You have a target. You do X-ray crystallography for the binding site catalytic site. You see the reactants before and the products after. You make an intelligent guess about what shape would fit in that transition state very well. Then you create a molecule that makes that shape. And there are products that do that. That are noted. Aspirin, of course, the universal analgesic fever reducer. They began to try to find alternatives to aspirin, and they began to look. Aspirin's a relatively simple molecule. And so they started creating molecules that had different shapes related to aspirin, but not exactly like aspirin. In other words, the molecule is not aspirin, but the three-dimensional shape and the polarity and non-polarity were similar to aspirin. And through a series of hundreds, thousands of different kinds of molecules that they made, they discovered you know, ibuprofen and Aleve and other compounds, naproxen, which is Aleve. Those, and they're doing that in intelligent design. Some of the HIV molecules, drugs that attack the active site of the reverse transcriptase were, in fact, intelligently designed that way. They isolated the reverse transcriptase. They found the catalytic site. They began to see what shape it was, would be idealized to have fit in there, and then they made non-reactive analogs. Boom, they got some good drugs for that. All right, so we're going to look specifically, if you don't mind, I'm back here. This, we're going to skip a bunch of stuff that deals with lysozymes, lysozyme mechanisms. So the book now is going to give us two examples of in detail of enzyme and enzyme activities. We're going to skip the lysozyme. We're going to go directly to the serine protease. All right, so that's what we're doing here. All right, so this is the serine protease. When we look at the active site, remember, the active site, I said, consisted of a catalytic site where the actual catalysis takes place and a binding site or binding pocket. Means the same thing, binding site and binding pocket. So a catalytic site, or I mean the active site, is composed of two different binding regions. They work together for selectivity. They work together for selectivity, but the binding site does not have any catalytic activity with it, and certainly appears that it's designed to help put the correct part of the molecule in the right position for the catalytic site, where selectivity among similar substances take place. Not always known with certainty. Location and composition can vary between similar enzymes, absolutely. Selection criteria, the distance of binding site from the catalytic site, shape, charge, polarity of substrate. Again, we're talking about, if you want to know what I'm saying when I say shape, charge, polarity, substrate, that's that geometric selectivity. That's geometric selectivity. It's not the stereospecific selectivity alone. It is the geometric selectivity. Again, shape, charge, polarity, the binding pocket. So those two things, the shape, charge, polarity of the substrate and the shape, charge, polarity of the binding pocket, this, I'm simply repeating geometric specificity in a new way here. Now, there are three very, very common, and there are more, but three common serine proteases that you're familiar with, I mean, just in common terminology. First one is called trypsin, the other is chymotrypsin, and the other is elastase. These are all proteases. What do you think proteases, what do proteases do? Break down proteins. These are digestive enzymes you find in your stomach and duodenum and small intestine, primarily in the stomach and duodenum. It's where most of the protein digestion takes place. And you see here that because I've placed them on this sheet, they're all serine proteases. Do not be mistaken. These serine proteases are not attacking serines. The serine proteases mean that you have a serine as a crucial amino acid side chain in the catalytic site. In other words, a serine protease uses a serine as the mechanism, as part of the mechanism for breaking the bond. So when you are listening to, in medical school, graduate school, dental school, or talking to your high school classes, and they ask, teacher, a serine protease, does that mean that it just attacks serine? No. No, Johnny. That means that the serine is a part of the mechanism of the enzyme. It's a part of the protein of the enzyme. So, if both trypsin, chymotrypsin, and elastase are all serine proteases, how do you differentiate between the two or three? This is where the binding site comes in. When they've done X-ray crystallography examination of the binding pocket or binding site, they discover trypsin has a charged, at the physiological pH that it works at, has a charged group at the bottom of the pocket. Do you remember what trypsin attacks? What does trypsin select for? I don't expect you to remember, but some might just right off the tongue. Was it lysine and arginine? And at physiological pH, lysine and arginine turn out to have what charge? Positive. Aspartic acid at that same physiological pH has what charge? Negative. So at the bottom of that binding pocket is the appropriate charge, and the depth of the binding pocket and other polar groups around, polar or nonpolar groups around the binding pocket, help select for the lysine and asparagine? Arginine? Whatever, arginine. When you look at chymotrypsin, chymotrypsin typically binds or selects for phenylalanine and what else? There was one other one. I keep thinking tryptophan. It can't be tyrosine? Phenylalanine? At any rate, I don't remember. The idea here is, if you notice here, it's a fairly shallow pocket, and the bottom of it has kind of a polar but not ionic compound here. Helps select for the phenylalanine. I think it's also tyrosine, but I could be wrong. I don't remember. Anyway, elastase, if you notice the elastase, the binding pocket for elastase has lots of hydrophobic residues. It's filled up, so only a small side chain can fit in there, and therefore elastase is alanine and I think also glycine. So anywhere there is alanine or glycine, it cleaves it. So this binding pocket helps with selectivity. Helps with the selectivity. Let's go on, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? Now, yes?
What keeps it from being, what keeps it from attacking itself?
Nothing.
So they break down themselves?
Yes.
They don't come in contact too much with a lot of protein?
Because the amount of material, yes. The trypsin and chymotrypsin and elastase are, in fact, relative to, thank goodness, at least, these enzymes are not present in physiologically relevant concentrations when your gut is empty. Okay, they're just not there, or else you would be constantly chewing up your intestinal tract. Because these things are completely mindless. Okay, they're basically a transformer that has gone nuts. Okay, or I don't know what you want to describe it. But what happens here is that they're stored synthesized in your pancreas and stored in the gallbladder in an inactive form, in the zymogen form. There's microscopic amounts of these enzymes that exist naturally, that exist in your gut, even when your gut is empty, but fortunately enough, it's not enough to attack significantly the protein of your intestinal wall. But you eat a nice lasagna dinner, for example, for lunch. You didn't have breakfast, you have a dinner, you have a nice protein, lots of fat, etc. There are nerve signals and hormone signals that then cause the smooth muscles of the gallbladder to squeeze. As the material dumps into your stomach and into your intestinal tract, and then high levels of these enzymes, I mean by high, I'm going quote, high levels of these enzymes then are released in the zymogenic form and then begin to act, well, there's a step in there, but begin to act on your proteins. There's only a catalytic amount of it, which means that there are 10,000 to 100,000 to a million times more targets than there are enzymes. But if an enzyme does run into an enzyme, you're right, that does exactly cleave it. They're not discriminatory between themselves. So, which is fine, which means that they are self-destructive. As the amount of protein in your gut decreases, the enzymes then begin to attack each other, make themselves inactive, and it's a self-destructive turn-off process. Remember, one of the rules of thumb, if a body turns on a process, then it has to have a mechanism to do what? Turn it off. Okay. So, whenever someone's talking about a process that does something X, you can, if you want to think ahead, you're going to have to go, all right, well, what turns that off? Okay, so the question is, what kind of chemistry did they use to discover the mechanism of trypsin? For example, I'm just going to use trypsin and serine protease. How do they know? How do they discover it? So we're actually, this slide is dealing with a little bit of chemical history. What is going on with this that they discovered it? Well, there is a compound called diisopropyl phosphofluoridate, DIPF. This material is interesting in the fact that it will be attacked by nucleophiles. It will be attacked by nucleophiles. Fluorine then, or hydrogen fluoride, becomes a leaving group. Well, it's not that good of a leaving group. Fluorine's not that good of a leaving group. So you have to have a fairly good nucleophile before this stuff will be attacked by that nucleophile. When they've done the sequencing of, when they did the sequencing of trypsin, they discovered that there was between 20 and 30 serines. When they exposed trypsin to that DIPF, one and only one serine out of those 20 or 30 was attacked that DIPF. Only one. And so they realized that there was something special about that serine. All the other serines were completely unfazed, but there was something about that particular and peculiar serine. All right, discovered that only certain amino acids were important in a component of enzyme activity, but how did they discover that? In discovering that that serine was important in this active site, they used what's known as this Trojan horse inhibitor. It attacked only one and only one specific serine out of the many in, well, I said trypsin. This uses the word chymotrypsin. It's the same thing. It's a serine protease. One and only one specific serine out of many in the enzyme chymotrypsin. So they knew that there was something special about that serine. Then they attacked it with other compounds that would be attracted to, you know, active enzymes, active side chains. You know, when you look at the list of amino acids, you'll immediately realize that if you're looking for an enzyme acid side chain, an amino acid side chain that could be chemically active, immediately the list decreases significantly. Because, think of it, alanine. What side chain does alanine have? Now, are hydrocarbons particularly chemically reactive? No. What about phenylalanine? Phenylalanine is composed of what? Benzene ring. Is that particularly chemically reactive? No. So they knew using the logic of an organic chemist that they weren't trying to find, you know, chemical reactivity in all 20 amino acids. They could quickly eliminate it, especially those that had, you know, an alcohol side chain or an acid side chain or a base side chain. So they weren't throwing random chemicals at these enzymes. They had intelligently targeted the kind of amino acid side chain they were looking for. They discovered that a second catalytic important residue using a Trojan horse, which means that a Trojan horse is one that once it's captured by the enzyme is never released. It becomes another way of saying a Trojan horse is called a suicide inhibitor. A suicide inhibitor. In other words, that inhibitor binds to the enzyme and never lets it go, which means that the inhibitor cannot be used again. Of course, neither can the enzyme. So, suicide inhibitor. Discovered that histidine active site was important. For chymotrypsin, it was chloromethyl ketone, PTKC. For trypsin, it's tosyl L-lysine chromomethyl ketone. And so what happens is, here's the histidine that was a part of the chymotrypsin, and there were other histidines besides this one, but only this one was attacked by this particular material and produced that suicide, that that covalently bound an inhibitor, and then they could degrade the enzyme and discover it was this chymotrypsin, this particular histidine, and they discovered eventually it was histidine 57 that did it. So they used chemistry to discover the side chains that were crucial for active site mechanism. So let's go ahead. And then they discovered this. So eventually they discovered that they're talking about what's known as a catalytic triad. Again, we're talking about the active site. This is where the actual electrons are manipulated and shifted to break the peptide bond in a protease. Comparing active site structures to a variety of serine proteases, such as sutilisin, chymotrypsin, serine carboxypeptidase 2, revealed that three amino acids were always present: His, SEER, and ASP. So the enzyme catalytic site had three crucial amino acid side chains always present: histidine, serine, aspartic acid. These three, while widely apart on primary structure, clustered together in hydrogen bond and hydrogen bonded to increase the activity of the serine side chain. So if you can imagine, you know, you got your arm stretched out and you've got, let's see here, how can you do this? How do you, can you floss with one hand? I mean, you can if you have a little machine, but can you floss with one hand if you're just using floss? No. You have to take this hand, and what do you have to do? You have to conformationally bend your arms to where it gets into very close proximity to each other so that you can manipulate the floss. And by the way, you guys do floss regularly, don't you? Absolutely. Whoa, too far. I don't know why I'm going that direction, but flossing is an important heart health activity that bacteria building up with unflossed teeth can, because of gingivitis, then have ready access to the bloodstream. And one of the places those they adhere to is your heart valve. So heart disease, oddly enough, has some mild correlation to gum disease and flossing. If you floss regularly, reducing your amount of gum disease. So when I floss, I'm actually thinking I'm helping my long-term heart health. It's one of the motivating factors, yes. Yeah, and plaque, exactly, which is the buildup of the bacteria producing a carbohydrate barrier to enhance their survival in a hostile mouth. So, all of that. So here you got, let's take a look at chymotrypsin versus this carboxypeptidase. Notice histidine, the chymotrypsin numbers, histidine 57, serine 195, aspartic acid 102. What they've done is they've arbitrarily said, well, here this is aspartic acid, serine. These are hundreds, 100 or so amino acid apart, but they fold in such a way as to bring the three of them very close together. Here's a catalytic triad: aspartic acid, histidine, and serine. Here's the backbone right here. The serine is sticking out into the active site. The histidine is sticking into the active site, and aspartic acid is sticking into the active site. So this ribbon right here of aspartic acid, histidine, and serine make up the catalytic triad for what class of enzymes? Class of enzymes. Class. That's an example of a particular class. What class of enzyme is this? Serine proteases. I say catalytic triad, you say serine proteases. Catalytic triad. Serine proteases. When I say catalytic triad, you think of aspartic acid, histidine, and serine. Catalytic triad. Histidine. Serine. Aspartic acid. All right. Now, they actually occur in a specific order. All right. What does that mean? All right. Hold on. Let's go back here. Aspartic acid at physiological pH is negatively charged. Histidine at this physiological pH has some hydrogens on it, but primarily the nitrogens don't have, it's not particularly protonated. So what happens is the aspartic acid pulls on the hydrogen of this particular amino group, which shifts the electrons such a way that pulls on the hydrogen, which shifts the electrons to be put onto the nitrogen.
that enhances the nucleophilicity of this nitrogen, which begins to pull on this hydrogen and the serine. And the electrons shift onto the serine oxygen to enhance its nucleophilicity. Let's see what that looks like right here. So this is the actual mechanism. This is taken from your text. You need to be able to, and here's the test question, I'm liable to cut this up and put it in random order. I want you to be able to rearrange this in correct order. All right? So it's not that obvious, honestly. There's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps, but it's not that obvious. Again, when I say serine protease, you say what? Catalytic triad. Now, here it is. Here's the aspartic acid. At physiological pH, it's negative, which means it pulls on the proton of that hydrogen. The electrons then begin to shift on the nitrogen, and because of this structure right here, oh, notice, single bond, double bond. What's that structure called? At least with carbons, it's called an allylic structure. Is that correct? Yeah. And notice, if you would, that allylic structure, electrons can be distributed over the two bonds in between here. The electrons move onto the nitrogen, which encourages the electrons to move onto that nitrogen there, which increases its basicity, which has a tendency to pull on the proton of that hydrogen, which enhances then the electrons move on to that oxygen, which make that oxygen more what? Nucleophilic. Did everybody believe me? Did everybody hear me? Is everybody paying attention to this? Okay? This is crucial. The reason why I'm making you go through this hassle is, this detail is, because this is a model for all the other kinds of enzyme mechanisms you're going to run across. Not every enzyme mechanism is even close to this, but it's that kind of logic in which there's a series of amino acid side chains that work together to enhance a particular characteristics of one amino acid side chain, which then does the actual action on the substrate. So you got this thing that now is highly nucleophilic. Here's the peptide substrate. Here comes in one part of the chain, there goes out the other. We're attacking the amide structure. Notice it's kind of reversed. Since this is a strong nucleophile, it attacks that carbonyl carbon through its backside. Oh no, more organic chemistry. What a nightmare. Then you get this temporary tetrahedral intermediate. Notice, you can also call this covalent, this is also a covalent type bond, a covalent mechanism, because the substrate is temporarily covalently bonded to the enzyme. So point at that oxygen-carbon bond and say, temporary covalent bond. Temporary covalent bond, indicating this is a covalent mechanism. You have this temporary tetrahedral intermediate, and that oxygen right there actually has a place to go. So this is what occurs at the transition state. This arrow could be reversed, by the way. This arrow could be reversed. But what happens is the electrons then shift onto this hydrogen, and from the base of this histidine nitrogen, and break that bond. So now what was one piece of protein is now two. Still bonded covalently to the enzyme is one fragment. The other is kind of hydrogen bonding. Guess what comes in? Water. It comes in, and as water comes in, it again gets acted upon by the histidine and becomes itself a strong nucleophile to attack that carbonyl group backside to break the covalent bond between the serine and the peptide, remaining peptide fragment. That breaks it. You see this new intermediate now where the electrons move onto the hydrogen. You have the carboxylic acid now of the remaining peptide fragment, and you finally have the remaining fragment released, and you now have the original catalytic triad already right here, all ready to accept another protein chain to fit in there. That's a serine protease. That's the mechanism. And to me, it's just absolutely fascinating how these three amino acids in concert can act to break that peptide bond so readily, hundreds, thousands of times a second in the right conditions. I had breakfast. Did you ever have breakfast? Excellent. I had breakfast. Let's see, what did I have? I had, again, I had my normal toast, peanut butter, strawberry jam. I'm starting to lose a little weight, so I didn't have any orange juice today. So, I know, orange juice? Well, you'd be surprised. If you actually cut out all calories by liquid, you'd be surprised. If that's all you did, you'd actually start losing a little weight. Just cut out all calories by liquid. Water, kind of thing. Amazing. Anyway, and don't substitute cookies. That's what I typically do. I didn't have orange juice today. Let me have this half a dozen cookies. Anyway, so notice that's all I have on this thing. That's all I have. Yes. No, they are planar. Did I call this SN2?
Yeah.
Did I say SN2?
Backside attack.
Well, it is a backside attack, but it's backside attack can occur on a planar thing. I mean, how could I do this? What's this structure? Let's see. Where are we here? Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not a backside attack, but it is. It's coming in on the backside of that oxygen right there. It's a planar attack. So if you've linked backside attack to exclusively SN2 kinds of reactions, is that correct? Really? Oh. Well, I think you could probably expand it a little bit. Depends on what you want to call. I don't care. What do you call it then? If you don't like to call it a backside attack, what would you call it?
Nucleophilic
acyl. Substitution? This is actually a substitution?
Well, acyl attacks.
Acyl attacks? Okay. Does that make any more, is it better sense to you guys if I say acyl attack? What? Sure, why not? Okay. Whatever. Whatever you learn, once you ever want to learn it as, that's fine. Okay, let's go ahead, shall we? Now, notice if you would, ladies and gentlemen, this structure right here, that tetrahedral intermediate. Circle that, if you would, gently. Don't mark it so you can't recognize it. But that tetrahedral intermediate actually shows up right here. Okay, now I literally retyped the caption for this because it said it so well and it is very meaningful. This preferential partial binding of the transition state or the tetrahedral intermediate over the enzyme substrate complex or acyl enzyme intermediate is responsible for much of the catalytic efficiency of... Oh, do you like that preferential? I think I typoed that, by the way. That's not the correct spelling for preferential. Efficiency of serine proteases. So here's the transition state. The transition state right here is actually stabilized by what they call an oxyanion hold. Thus, mutating any and all the residues, the chymotrypsin catalytic triad yields enzymes that still enhance proteolysis by 5,000 fold over an uncatalyzed reaction versus a rate of 10 to the 10. Similarly, the reason that DPF is such an effective inhibitor of serine proteases is because the tetrahedral phosphate shape makes this compound a transition state analog. Now, the transition state sitting right here, this thing is a transition state. In preparation for the transition state is this oxyanion hole that they've discovered and identified. It's sitting there waiting for the appropriate transition state structure to enter it and stabilize it. So here you got the carbonyl group, you got the nucleophile attacking the acyl substitution structure. And it produces a tetrahedral intermediate that's got a negative charged oxygen that sticks out there in tetrahedral format. This looks like it's flat, but that's not true. It sticks out there, and it's stabilized by these hydrogen bonds, that serine 195,
a group adjacent to the serine 195 and the glycine one, hydrogen right there, part of the amide structure. And so the oxyion hole creates that stabilized intermediate. Yes? Yep. See this tetrahedral structure? Is this thing right there? And this thing, see where this sits in here like this? This thing? Is this thing right there? So this is like step one, and this is the tetrahedral intermediate. And then oxyanion hole helps stabilize that tetrahedral intermediate preferentially over other things. That's why there's a transition state binding preferentiality. Do you like that new word, preferentiality? Okay, now then, zymogens. This is going to answer Mr. Shull's question specifically. So, pancreases produce all these enzymes. For example, trypsin, chymotrypsin. What prevents the pancreas from being self-digested by the enzymes it produces? The enzymes are not produced in active state. They're produced in an inactive state. That inactive state is given the class of enzyme called zymogens. So when I say inactive enzyme precursor, you say zymogen. Inactive enzyme precursor. Zymogen. Yeah. You guys, you would make a horrible choir, okay? Because we'd all be on a different page. Now, so zymogens. The O-gen is a clue that it's an inactive enzyme precursor. So you got trypsinogen. Guess what the inactive precursor is for chymotrypsin? Chymotrypsinogen. Inactive enzyme precursors, the active extra residues of zymogens distort the active site, making it active until the extra residues are cleaved off. So your pancreas makes chymotrypsinogen, trypsinogen, elastinogen, this kind of thing. Trypsin in particular has a segment of six amino acids that are extra relative to the trypsin. And so enteropeptidase, which is a secreted enzyme, or trypsin itself will come in and cleave that off. And when that gets cleaved off, the distorted active site folds into the active site, and boom, it becomes active. You can see for chymotrypsinogen, it's much more complicated. Chymotrypsinogen first gets acted upon by trypsin, then which becomes active, and then additional chymotrypsin attacks it and becomes alpha trypsin with these two fragments missing. So these are inserts. It's not only at the ends, but also chains within the primary chain are lost. And when those are lost, the chymotrypsin then folds appropriately to become fully active. Okay? So the zymogens are misfolded so that the active site is in fact distorted. When those extra amino acid fragments are removed, it folds properly and becomes an active enzyme. All right, we'll have to go on tomorrow on this. Ladies and gentlemen, see you Tuesday.